2 weeks after Biden granted TPS to Ukrainians. And that does it for our show. Happy early birthday to Tammy Woronoff. Democracy Now! Is accepting job applications. You can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Gezder, Messiah Ritz, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Woronoff, Camille Baker, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlon, Juan Carlos Davila. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio.
Hey, bluegrass lovers. Tune in Saturday, March 19th for 8 hours of homespun bluegrass for this year's Bluegrass Marathon. Hear from all your favorite Music from the True Vine DJs as they play for you home-recorded sets from your friends and neighbors. Again, that's the Bluegrass Marathon, Saturday, March 19th, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on KBOO. See you there.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland is on track for another record-breaking year of gun violence in the city. Campaign finance for foreign ballot measures in Oregon hit another roadblock. And a festival celebrating garbage comes to the Northwest. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 18th, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. 2022 is on track to surpass the gun violence record set last year in 2021. City officials held a press conference on Thursday, underlining efforts to stop the epidemic of gun violence. There have already been 20 murders in the city this year, and all but one were gun-related. Police Chief Chuck Lovell estimated that if the current trend continues, the year will end with around 1,500 shootings. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler said that even though gun violence cases are on a disturbing uptick, strategies like the Focused Intervention Team are working. He said they aren't just responding to violence, but also preventing it from happening in the first place. Deputy District Attorney Kirsten Snowden called gun violence a, quote, public health crisis, end quote. She also said that 12 to 15 prosecutors in the district attorney's office have left in the past year because their caseload is so extreme and causes burnout. Snowden described the district attorney's office, which is charged with prosecuting gun violence crimes, as being extremely overwhelmed. She said, quote, our criminal justice system is simply in crisis. We have reallocated the resources that we have to focus on gun violence. And I can say that, unfortunately, just this week alone, we initiated the prosecution in 3 separate cases where different people had been shot in the face, end quote. Ballot measures to limit campaign finance spending in Oregon have hit another setback. Secretary of State Shemaiah Fagan disqualified the measures in February because they didn't have the full text of the law included. Today, the Oregon Supreme Court unanimously decided not to direct Secretary Fagan to reverse that decision. The measures were created by Honest Elections Oregon, and they would give voters the choice to curtail the mass campaign spending that happens in Oregon. The Supreme Court said Honest Elections should have started the process sooner so that the error could be picked up before decision time. Honest Elections has until March 22nd to ask the court to reconsider. Secretary Fagan released a statement that she supports campaign finance reform in the state, but that, quote, whether by legislators or through the public initiative process, making law takes time. And the Constitution sets the rule of law. There are no shortcuts, end quote. One of the founders of Honest Elections, Jason Kafuri, accused Fagan of tanking the measure because it would limit contributions like the millions that labor unions contributed to her campaign in 2020. Fagan pushed back, saying that she voted for reform during her time in the Oregon legislature. Honest Elections Oregon must now decide whether to try to convince the state Supreme Court that they made a mistake. Lawmakers have suspended normal trade relations with Russia, and the State Department will document the evidence of Russian war crimes. With more on these stories, it's Dadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This bill also holds Belarus to account for its complicity in Russia's murderous aggression. They each will learn what every tyrant must. If you invade another nation, normal trade within our global economy is over.
Florida Democratic Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz spoke on the House floor Thursday as lawmakers voted to suspend normal trade relations with Russia, with a handful of Republicans voting no. President Joe Biden will speak to Chinese President Xi Jinping today as part of ongoing efforts to maintain open lines of communication. Biden has called Russian President Vladimir Putin a war criminal, a sentiment echoed by Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Pennsylvania Representative and member of the Foreign Affairs and Intelligence Committee Brian Fitzpatrick explained Putin's tactics.
When you're targeting locations that you know children are and you're bombing them and you're not allowing people safe passage out of the country that have nothing to do with the military, nothing to do with military installations.
Director of Human Rights Watch's Arms Division, Stephen Goose, says it has been documented cluster bombs, which explode in midair, have been used in populated areas in Ukraine.
Using them near a hospital is particularly heinous. They're a protected body under international law.
However, he noted, Russia, Ukraine, and the U.S. are not signatories to the international treaty banning cluster bombs. In a virtual address, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accused German leaders of putting their country's economic interests ahead of its response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, saying their support came, quote, too late to stop war. Germany is heavily reliant on Russia for its energy needs and has not banned Russian oil and gas imports. At a hearing Thursday, lawmakers scrutinized Texas's new voting law. Legal director of the voting rights program at the nonprofit Texas Civil Rights Project, Hani Mirza, says Senate Bill 1's voter ID requirements caused thousands of ballots to be tossed out in the March 1st primary election.
Everything that could go wrong with this process went wrong during the primary election, resulting in disenfranchisement of tens of thousands of eligible Texas voters.
Fox News is countersuing Smartmatic for financial damages over a $2.7 billion defamation suit the voting machine company filed last year over conspiracy theories claiming the company rigged the 2020 election against former President Trump. New Jersey Democrats are asking the Democratic National Committee to consider the Garden State for an early presidential primary. Some Democrats have criticized Iowa for going first in the primary process, particularly because of the state's lack of racial diversity. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Pharmaceutical manufacturer Moderna asked the Food and Drug Administration yesterday to authorize a fourth shot of its COVID-19 vaccine as a booster dose for all adults. Earlier this week, Pfizer asked for a booster approval for seniors, but the Moderna request is broader. Moderna said its request was intended to provide flexibility to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and medical providers to determine the appropriate use of a second booster dose of the mRNA vaccine. U.S. health officials currently recommend a primary series of 2 doses of the Moderna vaccine and a booster dose months later. Moderna said its request for an additional dose was based on recently published Omicron data generated in the United States and Israel. Meanwhile, the White House has suggested it needs Congress to urgently approve more funding for the federal government to secure more doses of the COVID-19 vaccines. Just over 1 week ago, the Shake Alert Early Earthquake Warning System launched in Oregon. Now, experts want coastal residents to be prepared for a potentially devastating tsunami. Important questions include how much time people have until the tidal wave arrives and where they can safely go. The Cascadia subduction zone is due for a large undersea seismic event, which could trigger a catastrophic earthquake and a tsunami along the Oregon coast. The The Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries released reports yesterday aimed at key tourist destinations in Clatsop County and the nearby communities of Arch Cape and Falcon Cove. The reports entitled Beat the Wave include detailed maps and hypothetical seismic scenarios. Different parts of Clatsop County have different risks, depending on the area's topography, when the tsunami is estimated to arrive, and the roads and trails available. It is also important to understand if the earthquake would cause local landslides or liquefaction, and whether or not critical roads and bridges would survive. In general, the reports recommend escaping tsunamis on foot rather than by car. Vehicles could be stuck in traffic as the water levels rise. It is also important to begin the evacuation as quickly as possible once a tremor is felt. There is some good news in the news reports. Safe evacuation is possible at a walk or slow walk pace from many of the more populated areas. However, that's not the case for downtown Cannon Beach. The distance from there to safe evacuation is both long and challenging, and evacuees would have to move quickly at what is described as a fast walk. The report said, quote, most of the community can travel at a minimum speed of walk, 2.7 miles per hour, and reach high ground ahead of the tsunami, end quote. The Oregon Geology website states, quote, we cannot prevent a tsunami, but we can prepare for one, end quote. This weekend, cities in the Northwest will have the opportunity to celebrate a festival with an unusual theme, garbage. KBOO's Maya LaPearl has more on the story.
Garbage Fest is coming to Portland this Sunday. It's a trash-themed festival featuring carnival games, puppets, and installations, all made out of garbage. I spoke with the organizer, Trash Being Seven, who told me something new will be in bloom along the East Bank Esplanade in Portland this weekend. Garbage Fest? What is Garbage Fest? What's going to be happening?
Yeah, sure. Well, Garbage Fest, it hasn't happened before, but in the future, we'll look back on Garbage Fest and really realize when all of our lives are just Garbage Fest constantly, we'll be like, oh, that's what we were doing all along. We were doing Garbage Fest. It's different in different cities, but there's going to be, you know, there's parades, there's a lot of puppet shows, a lot of people making different sort of horrible scratching sounds and howling, making different installations and monuments from garbage that they bring this kind of thing. We're going to have a lot of garbage carnival games, pin the garbage on the garbage, bobbing for garbage. Hopefully lots of garbage. Hopefully people will come and really be involved. You know, hopefully people will come and bring their garbage. We'll make a whole garbage economy and really redefining their whole relationship with use and utility and the idea of things being abject and cast off. Garbage Fest is really about to be in full bloom, and we're also excited about it.
How was Garbage Fest born? Where did the name and concept come from?
Well, originally there were three puppeteers from the Northwest who were talking about doing a puppet tour in the Northwest, they were like, let's upgrade this. We can do better than a puppetry tour. Let's do Garbage Fest. And that was how Garbage Fest was born.
That sounds super exciting.
There is a certain je ne sais quoi happening with garbage these days. It seems there's a certain pheromonal kind of blitz, I would hazard, where people are starting to reconsider this ontological feature of our post-late capitalist industry society. In Portland, we'll have a drag show that ought to be starting about 4. We're imagining sort of a rough temporal framework of about 3 to 7 in Portland, but it could extend on either side of that.
So if folks are interested in learning more, can they find that info anywhere?
I would say if you want to know more about Garbage Fest, definitely start spreading rumors about it. Talk to people, ask if they know about it. Maybe take a walk along the East Bank Esplanade Sunday afternoon. You might be able to email garbagefestnorthwest@gmail.com, and you might get some information out of that.
Perfect. That was Trash Being Seven with the exciting news about Garbage Fest. If you're in the Corvallis area on Saturday, you can find Garbage Fest happening at the Thompson Shelter in Avery Park. Here in Portland, you might find a flyer in the trash for an event under the Hawthorne Bridge on Sunday around 3 p.m. For KBOO News, this is Maya LaPearl.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines, produced by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. At 6, it's KBOO's Women's History Month series. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is cloudy, with a low of 46 degrees this evening. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy, with a high of 62. Today in history, in 2017, legendary American singer and guitarist Chuck Berry passed away. He was nicknamed the Father of Rock and Roll, and was one of the first musicians to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The quote of the day is from Greek poet and Nobel laureate Elitis, who died today in 1996. He wrote, quote, "Know that, as in life, there is much that many have looked upon, but few have seen, because as my father told me and his father told him, you will come to learn a great deal if you study the insignificant in depth." An elected official from New Mexico is headed to trial in Washington next week on a charge related to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Otero County Commissioner Coy Griffin has been charged with knowingly entering restricted areas of Capitol grounds. He is one of hundreds of pro-Trump supporters facing charges for trying to disrupt the certification of Joe Biden's 2020 presidential win, and his trial will be the second among many people arrested. Griffin is one of at least 10 people charged with the riot, who either held public office or ran for a government leadership post in the 2.5 years preceding the attack. Others include candidates for mayor in West Texas, city council in Kansas and West Virginia, county commissioner in Washington State, congressional seats in Florida, and state houses in Pennsylvania, New York, and West Virginia. Griffin served on the county's board for canvassing local election results. In 2019, he helped found Cowboys for Trump, aimed at spreading a conservative message about gun rights, immigration controls, and abortion restrictions. Griffin voted in January with his county commission to hire a private contractor to review the 2020 presidential election in Otero County, where Trump won with a 62% share. That review is still being conducted. Prosecutors have submitted a variety of images that show Griffin breaching barricades during the insurrection. Images taken by Griffin's own videographer show him using a bullhorn to lead the masses in prayer. That videographer has been granted immunity and is expected to testify at the trial. Griffin admits he entered a barricaded area, allegedly to reach an outdoor balcony of the Capitol, without going inside the building. His attorneys have demanded the prosecutors provide evidence that then-Vice President Mike Pence was still at the Capitol, a requirement for the U.S. Secret Service to invoke access restrictions. Griffin said, quote, "People are charged with entering an unauthorized zone, and it might not have been an unauthorized zone to begin with. That's the legal question right now. It's really a shame on Mike Pence's part, individually and personally. He should step up and let us know what time he left the building, unless he's trying to defend the government and trying to continue to make patriots suffer," end quote. U.S. District Court Judge Trevor McFadden ruled that prosecutors must call a witness with firsthand knowledge of Pence's whereabouts during the attack to testify if they want to try Griffin on a charge of entering and remaining in a restricted building or grounds. The judge did reject Griffin's accusations of misguided and discriminatory prosecution. State election regulators previously sued Griffin over his refusal to register Cowboys for Trump as a political group. Griffin says the group is a for-profit business and that he was worried about contributors being identified and harassed. He said he won't seek election this year as a commissioner or otherwise compete in the 2022 election cycle because he lost faith in the political system. At least 765 people have been charged with federal crimes related to the riot. At least 231 have pleaded guilty, mostly to misdemeanors. Griffin said he plans to show up for court on horseback in a show of support for former President Donald Trump. The Adolescent Redemption Project is a group founded by Joshua Puckett, who's been incarcerated in Michigan since age 18. The group is asking Michigan to release Everett Taylor, Breonna Taylor's father. He's been incarcerated since age 21. Lily Bulkey has more on the story.
The Adolescent Redemption Project is calling for sentencing reform and asking for Governor Gretchen Whitmer to commute the sentence of Everett Taylor, a Black man incarcerated in Michigan since he was 21. Taylor is also the father of Breonna Taylor, who was killed by police in her home after a no-knock warrant in Louisville, Kentucky, 2 years ago this week. Founded by Joshua Puckett, who's been in prison for 28 years since he was 18, the group advocates for people given life sentences as kids when scientists say their brains aren't fully developed yet. 23 years ago, Everett Taylor got a sentence of at least 45 years after a friend killed someone trying to rob them.
Back then, when I was younger, I wasn't really a responsible type dude, man. Even though I thought I was, but I wasn't. I was living a certain type of life when I was young, and certain things just come with it, man, either locked up or dead.
Before going to prison, Taylor had 6 children by age 19 and was selling drugs to support them. Research shows that the human brain doesn't fully develop until roughly age 25. Some states consider those up to age 21 to be juveniles in court. But in Michigan, 18-year-olds are legally considered adults. Taylor is serving 2 consecutive sentences, 25 to 50 years for second-degree murder and felony firearms possession, and 20 to 40 years for possession of marijuana and cocaine. He says it's because his drug trial occurred after the murder trial and the judge had no other choice because of mandatory sentencing law.
It shouldn't be no mandatory minimum. Let the sentences fit the crime, so to speak. You just can't put everybody under one thing right here. Because it's different circumstances and different situations just all the way around the board.
Studies have shown mandatory sentencing laws drive racial disparities in incarceration. The Adolescent Redemption Project advocates for giving judges discretion in sentencing so they can take such factors as childhood trauma and economic distress into account. This story was produced with original reporting from Josh Puckett with Yes Media. This is Lily Wolke with Michigan News Connection.
A proposed bill in the Alaska State Senate seeks to address high school dropout rates by putting the education plans in the hands of tribes. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A proposed bill in the Alaska legislature seeks to address high school dropout rates by putting the education plans in the hands of tribes. As KYUK's Olivia Eberts reports, supporters say tribal education compacts could lead to drastic improvements in education for Alaska Native communities.
Alaska ranks among the bottom states for graduation rates. And within the state, Alaska Native students drop out of secondary school at higher rates than their peers. According to data from the past 3 decades, schools in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region, where many students are Yupik, consistently have the highest dropout rates in the state. Supporters of a new bill think they can improve those outcomes by putting education directly in the hands of tribes. Senate Bill 34 would create a pilot program for Alaska Native tribes to begin running their own public schools through a compact agreement with the state of Alaska. Hooper Bay Elder William Nanning supports the Tribal Education Compacting Bill.
Our people and our parents want to learn. They want to see the students excel. Our people are going to school being very curious.
Nanning serves on the board of a new charter school in Hooper Bay whose curriculum is centered around Yupik values called Yuyarok. He hopes the state will choose his school for the pilot project. Nanning said that years of imposed colonial Western education in Hooper Bay has led to poor graduation rates. He worries this makes it look like Yupik people don't care about education, but he said that couldn't be further from the truth. Nanning says in order to succeed, students need to be taught in ways that are relevant to their lives. The Alaska Federation of Natives President Julie Kitka says it's clear the Western-centric model isn't working.
Clearly the state and the commissioners are already saying that the state is failing Native students right now.
The Department of Education says this bill is modeled in part on the success of a similar program in Washington State. Washington has 3 tribal compacted schools and they've done well. Back in Hooper Bay, the charter school's principal says this bill could allow her more consistent funding to hire local elders to help the teachers plan their lessons. Right now, elders are helping plan an entire curriculum around eggs. Bird eggs in the spring and fish eggs in the summer help infuse local traditions into traditional Western teaching. For National Native News, I'm Olivia Eberts.
Advocates in Indian Country are among those praising the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act to help strengthen safety in tribal communities, but say there were much needed provisions left out. CC Hovey is with Strong Hearts Native Helpline, a culturally appropriate domestic dating and sexual violence call and text support line for Native Americans.
each time Bauer is reauthorized, you see more and more improvements to the law and additional positive steps being taken to put an end to domestic dating and sexual violence in our communities. And we're really relieved that VAWA is continuing to be reauthorized.
Hovey says while they're thankful, there's more they'd like to see in the law, including addressing the boyfriend loophole.
This was removed from the latest VAWA from opposition from gun rights advocates, and this would have restricted dating partners and stalkers from obtaining firearms if convicted of domestic violence. And according to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, firearms are the weapon of choice for domestic violence homicides. 35% of all women are killed by intimate partners with guns, and nearly half of the women were killed by someone they were dating.
Hovey says another need is protection for elders.
Abuse can happen to anyone, and it's not limited to a specific age. And as Native people, we're taught to respect our elders, but they can still be victims of domestic violence, especially in multi-generational households.
Hovey says Strong Hearts will look for these to be included in the next cycle. VAWA, which was signed into law this week by President Biden, is reauthorized through 2027. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Hundreds of schools and organizations will host a teach-in on climate injustice. The Worldwide Teach-In on Climate Injustice aims to inspire students to take action. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In the 1960s, activists on many college campuses held events called teach-ins to raise awareness, foster dialogue, and inspire action against the Vietnam War. Since then, teach-ins have been used as an activist tool for all sorts of issues, including climate change.
It's a form of education that really engages students in the issues of the day.
Eben Goodstein is the director of graduate programs in sustainability at Bard College in New York. He's helping organize the Worldwide Teach-In on Climate Injustice on March 30th. Groups at hundreds of schools and organizations have planned panels and other events. Goodstein says it's a way for people from across disciplines to develop and share new ideas.
An artist might talk about how artists are responding to climate change. A religious studies professor can talk about stewardship. A business professor can talk about plunging costs for solar and storage. An economist can talk about the Green New Deal. Biologists can talk about ecological impacts.
He hopes the events will inspire students around the world to take action on climate.
It really is about student engagement with these ideas that will leave people energized.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 18th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, Josh Salem, and Maya LaPearl. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bolke, Nadia Ramlagan, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, it's worth our while to think about why practically everyone you know is talking about Ukraine and Russia's unlawful incursion. And it's equally worthwhile to ask why those same principles of concern don't seem to apply in other cases. Those feelings, after all, don't have to fight one another. But to hear Yemen put forward as a meme, as just an example of an under-considered concern, is galling from the same people who under-prioritized it in the first place. Yemen is not a rhetorical device. It's a country of human beings in crisis in which the United States is deeply involved. We'll talk about that with Yemeni activist and advocate Shireen Al-Adeimi. She's also assistant professor of education at Michigan State University. Also on the show, Sarah Bloom Raskin was up for a job at the Federal Reserve. Everyone was for her nomination, including the bankers that she would oversee. So why did she withdraw her nomination? And what does that tell us about the possibility of making any advances at all in addressing the reality of climate change? Helping us see why issues that media often divide are completely related is David Arkish, managing director of the climate program at the group Public Citizen. That's coming up. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. It's encouraging to see widespread recognition of the double standards of concern from media and politicians that we see reflected in the earnings.